Welcome to the Front End Nerdery Podcast, a podcast about front end development and design. I'm your host, Todd Libby. My guest today is founder and CEO of Super Friendly, co-founder and CEO of Arcade. He's a speaker, an author, and we have this thing where one person likes one NBA team and the other likes another NBA team. So we have a little rivalry going. My guest today is Dan Mall. Dan, how are you today?
I'm doing well. The Sixers are doing well. So yeah, everything is good.
Yes, they are. I wish I could say the same for my team, the Celtics, but...
I didn't say it.
Somebody had to. So, you know, would you tell us a little bit more about yourself?
Yeah, sure. So I run an agency called Super Friendly. We focus on design systems. We work a lot with in-house teams and help coach those teams to do better and to do work that they can't do on their own. Aside from that, at home, I'm a husband. I've been married to my wife for 13 years. We met when we were both in fifth grade, so we know each other for a long time. We have two kids. We have two daughters, a 10-year-old and an 8-year-old. I like taking photos. I like playing basketball. I like playing video games. I learned how to swim recently. So I think that's my recent life in a nutshell.
Well, that's awesome. So I'll just dive right into the questions. And, you know, I've followed you for quite a long time now. But how did you get started in your web development design journey? Is the first question.
Yeah. So I went to school for animation because when I was a kid, I always used to draw and, you know, read comic books and do cartoons and things like that. And so I wanted to make movies. Like when I first saw Toy Story come out, I was like, oh, people do this for a living. And so, you know, my whole life as a kid drawing and I was like, I want to be a Pixar animator. So I went to school for animation, and in school I realized I was awful at animation. It's so bad at it because it was difficult for me. And I saw other people just excelling at it. And I got lucky that my major was split between animation and this newfangled thing called digital design. At times, digital media. That's what it was. So I learned about Director and Flash and HTML and JavaScript and DHTML, you know, all that stuff. And I was like, oh, I actually like this stuff and I'm good at it. And so I discovered graphic design in college and became a developer, started as a developer, and then eventually became a designer after that.
Yeah, I remember Director and Flash and even dabbled in ActionScript and all that stuff.
Absolutely,
That was the good stuff.
I agree, yeah. Yeah.
I was just talking about the other day, Fireworks.
Yes.
Necromedia Fireworks was...
I mean, that was the tool set back in the day, right? It was like, I remember, you know, designing things in Photoshop and then slicing them up in Image Ready so that you can make HTML tables either by hand or in Dreamweaver or something like that and reconstruct your, you know, your Jenga piece, puzzle piece layout, you know, in your tables where you're nesting and merging cells and, you know, all that stuff. So... that was the workflow, and it's you know, it's amazing how much it has changed since then.
Sure has. So there's a few things I wanted to talk with you today about, and one of them is Super Friendly.
Okay.
You did go into a little, you know, told us what Super Friendly was about. Is there anything else you can tell us more about Super Friendly?
Oh, I could write books. What do you want to know? I initially started Super Friendly. So actually, Super Friendly's 10-year anniversary was Tuesday. So we've been doing it for 10 years. And in that 10 years, it has shifted and morphed. And we tried this thing and was this for a while. And then we tried this other thing. So initially, I started Super Friendly just as like, I don't know, Dan Mall's freelancing, right? That's And I didn't want to be like Dan Mall Design or, you know, I knew at some point I wanted to work with larger teams. But that's what Super Friendly was at first, was just a way to say like, I'm officially on the market, not working for agencies anymore, have my own, you know, which is basically just me. I'll take any work you got. It's mostly like a way to put food on the table. And I was fortunate enough for that to happen quickly. And I started to realize that like, I really believe that good work gets done in teams. When teams have good culture and they can work on a shared goal, you know, and things like that. So I've always done my best work in teams. I wanted that to happen more. It's super friendly. And so what I didn't want to do though is run an agency. What I didn't want to do is have like 30 people on payroll. And, you know, I've been part of places and seen other agency owners do that, like refinance their house because they can't make payroll 1 week, you know, like all of that stuff. It's a hard struggle. And one of the things that I learned early on was like, well, I have a good network of folks who don't want to be employed by me. I couldn't employ them, but they would love to partner up on things, you know, when the time suits. So like, that's how the model was born initially was, well, what if we could get together for a small amount of time, 3 months, 6 months, 12 weeks, you know, whatever it is, and then work on things for clients. And then everybody's free to do whatever they want after that. Like we can come together again. We could not. We could come together again partially, you know, that group and with other people. So, you know, I started to look around and like, what other models exist? Like, obviously I can't have invented this. And I'm like, oh, Hollywood does it. Like the way that movies are made. And there's a whole thing called the Hollywood model, which is that, you know, essentially everybody in Hollywood is a freelancer. All directors are freelancers, actors are freelancers, screenwriters are freelancers, and yet they come together. Thousands of people come together for years sometimes to make a thing together. And then everybody goes their separate ways. So I was just thinking about how that applies to digital and how it applies to, you know, making websites and apps and things like that. And it applies pretty well. So for a long time, you know, up until really 6 months ago, most of what Super Friendly was as a client comes in or we get a lead or something like that, we figure out what it means, what the client wants, what they're looking for. And then we go, do we know people who can provide that? You know, writers, accessibility folks, developers, designers, you know, whatever the project seems to need, who are the people that can fit that well? What superpowers do they have that can actually combine to make something larger than each of us could individually? So that's the model I've been running for about 10 years. I recently stopped, you know, about 6 months ago, and I can talk more about that. But like, that's worked well for the last 10 years.
Yeah, definitely. I've seen some of the projects you've done, and they're, lack of a better word, super.
So. Yeah. I mean, one of the things that I felt like I wanted to prove to myself was that like, it can be done. You know, that like, I think a lot of people, especially when I started, you know, 2012, freelancer had such an odd stigma, you know, like freelancer was like, oh, that's like a person who's not serious, who's like eating Cheetos and Mountain Dew in their mom's basement, you know, like, and I was like, I don't, you know, that's not everybody. That's not all freelancers. Some freelancers are great. You know, they're as professional as anyone else, are can do the work that they can. And I wanted to see if like, could we do that without everybody being W-2 employed? You know, is that possible to do good quality work at a large scale with high stakes? Can you execute on that? And I have at least a few examples of being able to say yes.
Yeah. And recently, was it a blog post that you wrote about some of the goals that you didn't hit, or, you know, it was very transparent. And I read it and, you know, one, you know, I admire somebody that is as transparent as that and says, here's what happened and got a lot to learn from it. And two, you know, a lot more respect, you know, because of that. Could you go into that a little bit?
Yeah, totally. So I wrote a year in review at the end of 2021. It's kind of a year in review post. I usually do two every year. I do one for like, here's a year in review of Super Friendly and how that's like work has gone. And then here's like a personal year in review for me. So in the Super Friendly one, the 2021 year in review, basically what I shared in that was on paper, everything's going in the right direction. You know, so like we're making more money, which I guess is what agencies are supposed to do, right? Like you're supposed to make more money and hire more people and work with more clients and more. But one of the things that I noticed was, you know, certainly on paper, at least, profit was going down. So like, well, that's like, it's odd. And that had started to happen the year before. And I think in the year before the year in review post that I wrote, it was like, well, I'm noticing that this is happening and this is something that I want to correct over the next year. But over the next year in 2021, that had started to fade, like continue to go down and to the right, which is not the way that you want that number to go. And so it was creating this weird split of like, well, revenue's going up, but profit's going down. And so and you could feel that in the work. And that's the part that's not on paper. You could feel that in the like, people aren't happy doing the work that they're doing. Clients aren't getting good results as a result of that. And I think a lot of that, you know, I own a lot of that as the CEO. In 2018, I think I moved to being like, I'm going to stop working on client work myself and try to be the CEO of a company. Like try to, and to me, that's like casting vision and painting pictures and saying like, this is where we need to go and how we need to get there. And, you know, trying to rally people around that. And I just learned that I'm not good at that. Like I'm not in that context. I'm not very good at that. I wasn't able to do that well with the folks that we had, you know, like I wasn't able to rally them to say like, this is how we need to do this. And this is why, and you know, all that stuff. And so that's mostly what I wrote about was like, it was the first year that we had to give massive refunds to clients. I mean, the only time that we've done that before is like 2014 or something like that. We gave $5,000 back to a client because we didn't think that we did a good job on it. This year, like clients requested it. They were like, we don't think that we got what we paid for. I mean, that's if that's not a wake up call, right? To say like, this is our livelihood. This is how, you know, the Super Friendly has always, and I think agencies in general always persist on the quality of their work. Mm-hmm. And so if you don't have that, you know, like, what are you trading on then? At that point, only reputation. And that's very flimsy. So, you know, before that got too dire, before it was like, well, we're running, we have no money left or we have no clients coming in. It's like, it's time to change that. Time to do something else.
It's a lesson learned. Nothing wrong with learning a lesson.
And I think that's the point of having a business. Like as a business owner, you know, part of the reason that I set up the business that way was so that we could change it if it didn't work. So that, you know, it's not like, oh, we have to lay off 100 people now. Like that, to me, that's one of the worst things you could do to somebody. You know, I'm lucky to never have been part of a layoff, but you know, just observing it and seeing how that happens to people, like I bet it sucks. And so I didn't want to build a company the way that most agencies do, which is, oh, we got a giant account, let's hire 20 people. Oh, that account didn't renew, let's lay off 15 of them. You know, like that happens all the time. And I just feel like I think there's a kinder way to do that. You know, even if it's more, even if it's whatever, you don't make as much money doing it. I think, you know, I don't think that's it at the end of the day. So part of it was, if we learn something, if we learn that we're not doing something well, shouldn't we change it? You know, and a lot of people don't change it because they have a lot of things in place that make it difficult to change. But with Super Friendly, there aren't a lot of things in place that are difficult to change. So why not take advantage of that?
Yeah. And it's, I, you know, from an outsider's perspective, it's a great model for a business. When I read that, I was like, well, you know, you don't see that often, is somebody saying, here's how it is, you know, here's what happened. And, you know, this is how I feel and what I think. And, you know, I think I said in a tweet, I was like, I applaud it. You know, I'd like to see more of it, but
yeah, thank you. I would like to see more of it too. I find that I'm drawn to people who are sharers, you know, like people who share what they do and what they've done and how they do it and how they feel and how they think. And I'm like, well, if I'm drawn to people like that, like maybe it's because I want to be that kind of person too. So I have to actually try to be that kind of person and do those kinds of things too. And I feel like that, you know, I have benefited greatly from other people sharing things with me. So I feel like, you know, it's the least that I could do to try and share what I have done or learned, or, you know, the good, bad, and the ugly. A lot of people share the good, you know, especially in whatever Instagram influencer days that we live in. Like everybody's life is peachy. But I think that's half the story. So we gotta know the other half too.
Moving away from that, and if there is anybody listening out there that's looking for somebody to do work for them, you know, I Super Friendly, you know.
Thanks. I'll send you a royalty check in the mail for that. Thank you.
So I wanted to pivot to, you were in the and I have one around here somewhere. It's from a long time ago. The pricing guide. You were in the pricing guide for.
It was the price. I always fumble around the title. It's such a long title. The handbook. Yeah. Of ethical and pricing, the Graphic Artists Guild Handbook to Pricing and Ethical Guidelines, something like that, which was, you know, a Bible for me growing up in design, like always consulting that thing. And in the latest edition, they did a feature on me and a bunch of other studio owners and freelancers and stuff. So very honored to be part of that.
Yeah. Well, congratulations, first of all. Second of all, you know, Speaking of books, because here's where the segue goes. Uh-huh. You have a book, Pricing Design, and it's been out for a while, but I wanted to talk about it. I've read it. It's one of the short books from A Book Apart, and I love A Book Apart. I have them all. That's how dedicated I am to those books.
Yeah, same.
I read it, took a lot out away from it. So thank you. That helped me when I was on my own, because when I had to do everything, I was like, this is kind of like one of the Bibles that I use. So again, thank you for that.
Thank you.
Could you tell people about, because, you know, let's try to sell some books here.
Yeah, sure. All right. Let me put on my sales pitch hat here. The book is called Pricing Design. As you said, Todd, it's a short book. It's about 40 or 50 pages. I forget how long my book is. 50 pages. You know, you could read it on a flight or a particularly vigorous restroom trip or something. It's about how it's for agency owners. It's for freelancers. It's for anybody that prices their services. It's called Pricing Design, but it applies to pricing, you know, anything, development, you know, any kind of service. And the basic gist of the book is around a thing called value pricing, which is the idea that, if I simplify it, it's the idea that any price should be a price that's worth it to both parties. And a lot of people don't work that way. I think said that way, I think it's simple, and I think everybody would be like, yeah, that makes sense. But a lot of people don't price that way. A lot of people, and not because they think it's wrong or anything, but like, because we don't talk about pricing, to the thing that you and I just talked about transparency.
Yeah.
Not, a lot of people are very secretive about pricing, and I think some rightly so, but I think because we don't talk about pricing a lot as an industry or as a craft, you know, like that part gets like, well, you just figure that out. And what people do is they ask a friend and they go, hey, what do you charge? Oh, I charge $100 an hour. Okay, I'm going to charge $100 an hour. Like, and that's one way to do it, but it's not the only way. So what I wanted to do in the book was expose, here are a bunch of different ways to do pricing. Here's the one that is my favorite and the one that has worked the best for me when I was freelancing as a solo entrepreneur and also running an agency. We value price just about everything. You know, I could probably count maybe 4 times in the 10 years that we haven't value priced, and they were worse for us. But the book is basically about, here's what that pricing approach entails. Here's how you do it. Here's how you understand it. And then here's a bit of a case study on how it works.
Yeah. And really, if anybody finds themselves, you know, thinking about any of that, they should pick up that book, because I think it's still pretty, it still holds, you know, it's one of those timeless classics. How's that?
That's right. Yeah. You know, it's like Dickens and then Pricing Design. It's like in the same ballpark for sure.
There you go. Yeah. So I just wanted to mention that because, again, great book. And, hopefully you get at least a couple sales from this podcast.
I would love it. That'd be great.
So the meat and potatoes of this episode that I wanted to bring you on for was, let's talk about design systems, because I have some questions about design systems that I've had people, you know, ask me about design systems, but also in the order of the accessibility of design systems.
Yes.
And so I guess the first question is, here's a sports analogy that I know you know. I'm going to softball this one in.
All right.
When should design systems be implemented in a project?
Oh, that's a good one. My general take on that is, I think design systems are larger than a project. So I think I think about them in the context of an organization. And I think of it as any organization that is managing 2 or more digital products, or will, time to start thinking about design systems. If you're making a one-off website, I don't know, will a design system work for you? At some point, it might be too high of a level of investment to pay off. If you're like, you know, we have one website that we maintain, or we have one app that we maintain, like maybe you could make a case for why it could help. When you're talking about 3 websites you're trying to maintain, or 12, or 30, or 300, or thousands, design system is going to be a force multiplier for you. So I generally say like 2 or more is probably the time where you want to start thinking about that.
Second question. I've been asked this And I think it's very important, but how important and impactful can a design system be for an organization?
I recently worked with a client. I wish I could talk about it, maybe soon. And we were working on like a pitch to executive leadership, right? So the design team and UX team are kind of working on design system and saying like, if we scale this properly, this is the impact that it could have. And I think like seriously, the numbers in that deck, it was like, we could save 16 million hours of something. We could save $20.8 billion of like astronomical numbers. And they were all, when I looked at them, I'm like, well, it actually makes sense in this context. Like at this size of an enterprise, yeah, we're talking about $20 billion. We're talking about 16 million hours over the X amount of years. And I think it sounds like monopoly money and it sounds like, you know, just astronomical numbers, but a design system deployed well is a tool of scale. And when you're working at scale, you make mistakes at scale, but you also get rewards at scale too. So done well, you know, done perfectly, that's what the opportunity is. I don't know that I've ever seen any organization do it perfectly, but some fraction of that, they could do half of it, you know, like a quarter of it, three quarters of it. That's still lots and lots of savings, not just from an efficiency standpoint. Like that's the tip of the iceberg. You know, you can be more efficient, but then after that, like you could be more innovative, you know, leading to new product creation or new areas for the company to explore, all that stuff. Design systems are a way to open that stuff up. So I think that they are a tool at scale. And depending on the scale you're talking about, you could very literally see like saving millions of dollars or this, you know, hundreds of millions of hours or whatever, you know, that just seem ridiculous, but actually aren't that inaccurate.
So that kind of ties into my next question, because I usually say, and I'm not, you know, I don't want to say foremost expert, but I'm not, I know enough to be dangerous. How's that about design systems?
Sure, yeah, totally.
It ties into, for me anyways, that you have a design system, you have something to go with, moving forward that helps, you know, create your brand or what the product or whatever. And then developers, designers, they don't have to go back and they don't have to fix things and then come back again. There's not this back and forth, I guess. I'm trying to say here. Because in a talk I give, I mentioned design systems and accessibility. And when a well-built design system is implemented, it helps with that, you know, not going back and forth. It helps with accessibility. And when that design system is built, keeping accessibility in mind, the design system can be great. So how important are accessibility and design systems coexisting together?
So important, critically important. Mm-hmm. And I feel the same about anything that can have impact at scale, right? Because so good design, you know, like design systems, I just retweeted something earlier today about like design systems isn't where innovation should happen, right? That should happen on product design. And I think what design systems allow is it enables the better process of creating products, creating things that people can use, whether those products are websites or applications or, you know, whatever those are. Design systems are a tool to enable that to happen faster, bigger, you know, like at scale. And other things can happen at scale when you have a vehicle for scale too. So that's why a lot of times, you know, accessibility is tied on to design systems, or a lot of times the other way around, design systems are tied on to accessibility initiatives, because design systems are in some contexts a little bit more opaque. Like people don't understand them as well as they do accessibility. And a lot of that, unfortunately, is negative. A lot of that is, well, we know that other people have gotten sued for accessibility. And so has to become an initiative, and we're going to do it across all of our different, you know, orgs or our different teams or whatever. So accessibility is at least recognized in that way. Ideally, it's more recognized for positive things than negative things, but okay, fine, whatever, like wherever we need to start, I guess. Same thing with performance too. You know, like a lot of times design systems and performance initiatives are tied together because again, you're looking at scale. You're looking at, well, across our whole organization, our whole suite of apps or products, we want to improve performance by 5%. Or like, that's not a thing that you can do project by project. That would take 4 years, you know, at certain places. So instead we go, well, if we had all of this connected systems, all these connected systems, then we can make a change in one place and it trickles out everywhere. And I think that, so that's why accessibility, you know, is so closely tied to design systems. And I think, you know, rightly so. I think the mantra that we hear a lot though, which I agree with, is that, you know, accessible components don't mean you have an accessible experience for people. Which I agree with that. Like if you have, you know, you might have an accessible tab set, but implement it in a product inaccessibly, right? So like, I think it's Derek Featherstone that always gives this example that you could have an accessible modal, an accessible tab set, and an accessible accordion. But if you nest that accordion inside the tab set, inside the modal, inside the page, you could very quickly create a terrible experience for someone, you know? And so I think that what design systems enable though are process. Like they enable better workflow. And if you have that culture and that workflow, then you can spot accessibility things at the page level, at the experience level much better, because now the team knows how, oh, this is how design and engineering work together. This is how we test. This is how we do this thing. And like, that's really what design systems are. You know, at a most philosophical level, like I like how Brad Frost says it. He says like design systems are the story of how an organization creates digital interfaces. Mm. It's the story. It's like, this is the way we do things. So if the way that we do things is every time we build something, we test with people who have disabilities, or every time we create something, we involve people who have disabilities, like that's what design systems enable. And that's the way that we do things here every time. This is how we do it with performance. This is how we do it with engineering. This is how we do it with design. This is how we do it with UX. Anyway, I'm preaching. I'll stop. But like, that's why I think they're so tied closely together, is because they're both enablers. So when you put them together, they're, you know, they're even better.
Yeah. And the way I've kind of fumbled through an explanation to people is when you have those things streamlined, it makes the process so much easier for an organization, for those people, that the designers and the developers, everybody else involved as well, to do their job. And then that leads to, like in my talk I gave, you know, explaining design systems and tying that into accessibility, it leads to less stress. You're not wasting as much money, and you have a happier organization, and yes, you're doing it for people that are, you know, on the other side of the glass, as Mike Montero puts it. And I love that. I love that quote. So I stole it. Yeah. It just makes it so much easier. And I just think about when I see somebody, you know, we're doing this again. And I just think about if everything was streamlined with the design system and everything we've been talking about, that we wouldn't see tweets like that, or we wouldn't see blog posts like that. And that would be so much better to see, you know, see more happier designers and happier developers. So
I'm really glad that you brought that up, because I think that's the part about design systems that don't get talked about as much. I'm happy to see people talking about it more, but the rhetoric around design systems is usually around efficiency. And like, yeah, I mean, that's true. It's not false, you know, or consistency. You know, design systems will help you build more consistently and more efficiently. True, but who cares? Like, I've seen lots of efficient things that no one cares about. You know, like there's, and so the part to me that I like talking about, and similar to you, is like design systems should be a relief to people. You know, because if they're not, the opposite of that is design systems become a chore. You know, like a lot of designers who are less familiar with design systems go like, well, wait, a design system just means like everything's out of the box now. So like, what's my job? Like what? Never mind. I don't care about that then. I don't care. But instead, design systems should be like, oh, thank God, I don't have to do that part anymore. Now I can go do this other part. My job's more fun. And I think that's where I love how you said happier companies, happier organizations, because that's where we see like retention rates increase. And that's where we see like people have more higher job satisfaction. And like, those are the kinds of things that solve a lot of our problems in tech, you know, not all of them, but like, I think it was Cameron Moll who shared this the other day on Twitter or something, but he said like, instead of worrying about your people getting headhunted, instead worry about why they're taking those calls in the first place. Like, fix that problem first. You know, then you won't have to worry about them getting hit headhunted. You won't worry about them getting recruited away, you know, or at least not as much, because you fixed the root of the problem. And I think that's the thing, is design systems should be a thing that solved the root of the problem, which is like all the stuff that can be automated, let's just automate that stuff. How many times do we want to redo drop-down menus? Like, I mean, like, really, is that what we're going to spend our time on as an industry? You know, we can literally fly people into space and we're going to spend like weeks and weeks on drop-down menus. It's just, you know, it's bananas. So that's the part, you know, I love talking about that part most, is what do design systems free people up to do? Like, what happens then? You know, that's when we're really seeing the value of that. Accessibility should be a thing that we just take for granted. Like, yeah, it's accessible. Like, the fact that we have to work on it sucks. You know, the fact that we have to like worry about, is this design going to be a good user experience or a bad user experience? Like, that stuff should be automated away by now.
Yeah,
definitely. You know, and then we should focus on other things, cooler things, more useful things, more fun things. Anyway, I get all riled up about it. Gets me in the feels.
And I also want to throw in there too, because I had somebody ask me, you know, is a style guide a design system? And I said, no.
Right.
No. So I did learn a few things from going to an event apart. So. Nice.
Yes. I mean, it's part of, you know, style guides are part of them. Like, they're important. But, you know, design, at least the way that we define it at Superfriendly, design systems are software products. Yeah. Like, they're a piece of software that is connected to all your other software. And the connected part is the important part. Style guides typically are not connected. That's what makes them part of a design system, but not a design system as a whole. Connected means it's, you know, it's a dependency in your software. It means if you change one thing here, you have the ability to change something else automatically. Like, that connection part is the system part of it. Otherwise, it is just a guide. It is just a thing that says, like, I don't know, you should do it this way, I guess. Good luck.
Do you still see a little confusion out there with the two?
Yeah. Almost every time that we work with a client. And I'll admit, it's a little bit self-selecting in that the organizations that already know what a design system is and they have it down and all, like, they don't come to us, right? They're not the ones that are like seeking help in it. So a lot of the clients that come to us are not necessarily coming and saying like, oh, you do design systems, can you build a design system? Some of them are, but a lot of them are saying like, we have this problem where like we have to change this thing, but then we have to change all these other things too. And that seems like 4 years of work. Is there a way to do that better? And we're like, yeah, let us tell you about a thing called design systems, you know, and then everywhere in between. The first thing that we do on almost every engagement that we work on is we say like, let's define the terms. Like, let's be shared on the definitions. This is what we mean by design system. You will hear other versions of it, and that's not wrong, but this is what we're talking about. So let's at least align on that. What we're talking about is creating a software product. And this is what that software product is supposed to do. Here's how it's going to be implemented. This is what we mean by that. And a lot of people go like, I don't agree with that. And then they don't work with us. And then other people go like, ah, that makes a lot of sense. We would like to do it that way. And then they do work with us. Right. You know, so I think that's the first thing we do is go like, let's make sure we're talking about the same thing when it comes to design systems. A lot of our prospective clients say like, we want a design system. And then as we dig into it more, what they mean is we want a shared set of templates that has shared, you know, design language and things like that, which is like, cool, that's useful. That's not what we're talking about though. Mm-hmm. So, you know, just aligning on like, this is what it is. This is what we mean it to be. And if you work on it with us, this is what you're going to get at the end. It makes some clients go like, oh, that's not at all what I wanted. I'm like, great. Better to find that out now than 14 weeks later, you know, when you're requesting a refund that like, that's not what I thought that I was signing up for.
Yeah, definitely. So I was thinking of this question before we jumped on the call, and I really didn't know a better way to word this. So I was just asked, what can people do, or what can organizations do to make their design systems accessible if they aren't? And, you know, what steps can they take to streamline the process and make them accessible?
I mean, you probably have a better answer to that than I do, but I'll take a stab at it, you know, and please feel free to correct me on this or add to this. You know, I'm not by any means an accessibility expert. It is important to me in the work that we do. I always advocate for it, but I also always look to learn more about it and partner with people who are doing it, you know, more than I am. one of the ones that I use all the time when I'm building something or designing something, especially, you know, for the web. And I definitely got this from, I learned a lot of my accessibility stuff from people like Derek Featherstone and Sarah Sweden, who like really, really dig into what it means to do it well, you know, as a craft. One of the things that always stuck with me is like test with the keyboard. Like I'm fumbly around screen readers, you know, like I use VoiceOver every now and again, but I don't even know exactly how to use it. But like the keyboard, I know how to use. And if I can get through my site with a keyboard, that's a good first step. If I can like, if I can click that link, if I can get over there, if I can, you know, scroll down the page, if I can read the headings, if I can do all that stuff, that's a good place to start. So that's the first place that I, you know, whenever I'm working with designers who don't know very much about accessibility, you know, on client teams, they go like, well, you know, like what they know about accessibility is color contrast. I'm like, great, that's a good thing. So great, let's focus on color contrast. And then also let's try this thing. Let's go through it together. Let's just tab through this page and see how it goes. And then that makes them go like, oh, I don't even know where I am on the page. Ah, cool. So let's talk about focus states then. Let's talk about, like, it opens a door to all of those things. So that's usually where I start, is let's just tab through this page. And what that exposes is some designers go like, well, all we have is a Figma file. I'm like, okay, so then we don't have a real product yet. We have some paintings that are nice. Let's get this into a browser and see what it does. And they go, how do I get in the browser? Well, I don't know. How would you get it in the browser? I mean, I guess I could ask that engineer over there if like he could spend a little bit of time, or she could spend a little bit of time with me to like, and it just opens these doors that I think designers who are designers or engineers who are engineers and purely sit in their silos, their purview is shallow. You know, the purview is, accessibility is only about ARIA roles. Well, not really. Like, accessibility is only about color contrast. I mean, that's a part of it, but there's a whole world there. You know, and so let's be more inclusive of even just our team members. You know, like, you know, and then once we can create that practice, then it opens the door to, well, let's be more inclusive of people who are going to be using our product, not just making the things that we're making, but using these things. Yeah. You know, and that to me is a gateway from, you know, accessibility as a checklist to a process of inclusive design, you know, and how you get there. And so again, not an expert, that's my experience and like what I've done so far. I'm sure there's stuff that's missing from that, but like, I like things that open doors that then people can go like, I really want to dive deep into this. So I'm going to go become an expert on, you know, color luminance because I realize how important I'm. Great. Excellent. Like, and then bring that back to the team and share that knowledge with everybody else too. I don't know, Todd, what did I miss?
There's so much to accessibility.
Right?
So much. I don't think we have time.
Exactly.
There's so much. I find myself taking long walks and, you know, taking a few breathers now and then and just saying, okay, you know, I can get through this. But yeah, definitely. No, that was that was a great answer. I get that question some of the time. And I'm like, yeah, I'm no design systems expert, but, you know, accessibility, I can tell you a little bit about it. So, yeah, that's great. So my final question before I get to the big three is kind of, I ask this question and I ask it kind of hesitantly, and that is, who's going to finish ahead of one another, the Sixers or the Celtics?
Oh boy. I will not take the bait of trying to answer that question accurately. What I will say is Sixers in five every year. That's my answer. So I'm not gonna take that question from you. I'm just gonna say we're going all the way this year. Yeah. Like I say every year.
Yeah, I'm having an up and well, you know, just like teams lately in New England. It's been an up and down couple of years. So
yep, yeah, I hear that. Yep.
So yeah. Okay. The final three, the hot seat questions. Are you ready?
I'm ready. Let's do it.
All right. So number one is, what about the web these days excites you and keeps you excited in what you do?
Honestly, not a lot. I haven't been seeing things on the web that I'm like, this is awesome. At least not as much as I used to. I will say though, that because my attention is on design systems so much, when I see a design system that looks great, like when I see a website that looks great, that I know is built on a design system, I'm like, yes, there's a good example of it. Cause I think we see a lot of examples of like, well, design system work kind of makes like drab websites, right? Cause it's like just boxes, you know, that we're putting together. So whenever I see something that's beautiful, that there's a system to, whether it's a software product design system definition, like I'm talking about earlier, or it's just like, I don't know, the design language is beautiful. To me, the Oculus site, I've spent a lot of time on that site lately. And I'm like, it's beautiful. Like it's simple. It seems like there is a design language and an art direction, you know, system consideration to it. It seems expressive where it needs to be and not where it doesn't need to be. So I like seeing a lot of that stuff lately. I've been taking a lot of inspiration from that site.
Second question. If there were one thing you could change about the web that we know today, what would that be?
Todd, these are heavy hitters, man. Okay. One thing that I could change about the web. I think it's still too hard to make for the web right now. It like build tools and however many design comps we need to, like it's just broken. I love, and this relates to the first question, I guess. I love seeing all the developments in like the no code movement and, you know, like that's the stuff that makes me go, I could get my kid to use that. You know, if you want to be my kid's 10-year-old and 8-year-old, you want to make a website? I don't go, all right, let's spin up an NPM packet. You know, like okay, NPM install this. They'd be like, what? I'm like, let's open Webflow and we'll just build a thing. Like that, I like that. I think it's too hard for people to make for the web still. I think it's getting more difficult, which sucks. It should be getting easier. But I think tools like no code tools like, you know, Framer, like all that stuff. I'm loving where that stuff's going.
Third question. Favorite part of development or design front end that you really like the most, that you nerd out over, and I think that would be design systems. Am I correct?
Oh, that's a good. It's not design systems.
Okay,
it's not design. It's things that are clever.
Okay,
like I love seeing, because at some point design systems, like they all are going to be the same. You know, like material design and ant design and this and that. Like it just bootstrap. It's all bootstrap, right? It's all it's all buttons and boxes and links and text. So yeah. Fine. But there's the stuff that goes in them. Whenever I see little trinkets like that, I'm like, this is great. Like little moments, you know, sometimes like little pieces of copy that like a whole web page that's serious, but then there's a joke somewhere. I'm like, yes, that like somebody paid attention. Somebody cared about that. Because I think, you know, contrary to my last answer, I said it was hard to make web things. For people who do make web things, it's easy to make boring ones. It's easy to make standard things. Like, cool, we can do that. We do that all day. But I think anything that shows a little elevated something, you know, something that's animated that doesn't need to be, that wasn't on like a product manager's like, well, we have to do this though. Like something, a piece of copy that didn't need to be like that, a design element, I'm a big fan of doing things the long, hard, stupid way. I think that's a blog post that Frank Camaro wrote at some point or something. And it's like I think that's the stuff that excites me about the web is when people sometimes just do things the long, hard, stupid way. When somebody writes, you know, an SVG by hand and animates it by hand, like you could tell, you're like, look at that. The thing is saucy, you know, like it's just those things, the sauce. That's the stuff that I really like. So I like finding those. I feel like I'm finding them less and less nowadays, which I think is sad. But every time I find it, I'm like, yes, somebody who cared about this. And I think that we should celebrate that more.
And I got to ask, I'm going to throw one more question here because I got to ask the photography. I mean, I see some of the photography and I'm like, come on. I can't operate a camera like that.
I also wasn't able to. I think it was a pandemic thing, although it started a couple years before that. But certainly with COVID, I'm like, I think I need creative outlet that's not business related. Like, because, you know, I get to do that for my job every day, which I'm grateful for. I get to design and develop and do all those things that clients pay for, but it's different. And it's nice to have a hobby that's not, and like when I do photography, I can't think about anything else, you know, because I'm looking for the shot that I want. And I'm not so good at photography that it's like, oh, it's like, it's natural. And I just shoot and whatever comes up. It's conscious work for me to go like, what f-stop do I want here? And what should the ISO be? And, oh, why should it be that? Like, so I'm still in that kind of beginner mode where I'm like, oh, I have to be like literally dialed in, you know, to it. And I can't be thinking about, oh, what do I have to do for work tomorrow? What do I have to, you know, what deliverable do I have? I'm not there. I'm fully present in photography work now. And I just do it for fun. You know, I go out and shoot with friends and, you know, we go out to where, let's go to the lake, you know, over here and see what's over there. That's cool. And it's just this creative pursuit of like, and it fails a lot too. Sometimes I go out and I shoot 1,000 photos of just nothing. You know, and I'm like, I literally got no good shots today. I just got like some dirt or some trees or some this, like nothing. And so I've really been liking the challenge of, it's like multiple challenges stacked on top of each other. It's finding something really interesting or finding a framing on something that makes it interesting and then capturing it well, technically. You know, it's just all these different layers of challenges that when I get something, I'm really proud of it. And a lot of times I don't get something and I'm like, I want to go out and do it again. So it's really been helpful for my mental health lately.
Yeah. I did that, it's still work. It's a lot of work, but I kind of did the same thing with this podcast. You know, it's like going into a pandemic and I don't want to be walking around a house in my own head because it's a dangerous place to be.
Totally. So, yep.
That's how, you know, this is more. Granted, it's still talking about work. Well, it's not really talking about work, but it's still talking about stuff that I deal with kind of, you know, on a daily basis. But it's still, the biggest thing is it's been fun.
Yes.
And everybody, you know, who I asked, you know, would you like to come on the podcast? Nobody said no. And I asked a lot of people. I was like, nice. Wow, I have more than a couple of seasons of people that I need to talk to, I guess.
That's awesome. I love that. For a while. So when I stopped doing client work at Super Friendly, I think I just stopped having fun. I think that's why I didn't succeed at the CEO stuff, is because like, I think I'm a maker at heart. I believe that everybody's a maker, right? Like, but I like making things and, you know, sometimes not just making like a vision board, you know, like sometimes just making something tangible. You know, going like, I made that design. And so I think that there's got to be that work overlap. Because to me, even when I'm doing photography, I'm opening design tools, I'm editing, I'm, you know, I'm uploading it here. I'm doing strategy work the same way that I would do on a client project or at work, right? Like I'm still using those same tools, but for a completely different output. So I think if it was completely outside of it, I don't know. I mean, I'm good at work. So to take those skills and apply them to something else, I'm like, I want to be good at it too. I don't know that I don't know how much I can stomach being so bad at this thing for such a long time, you know, that I would just give up. So I think that if for us who, I mean, this is such a weird industry in that we're like one of the only ones who do the same thing for a hobby that we do for a profession. You know, like I don't know any plumber that like does plumbing on the side, like side projects, you know, like other than maybe their own house, you know, but they're not like, let me go, you know, somebody who works, I don't know, like you get what I'm saying, but we do. So I think that we do get to mix that stuff. I think that's an advantage and that's a good thing that we have a benefit. It's just, it's tough when it overruns our lives. Yep. But I think being able to use the same skills elsewhere and something that's fun. Oh, so my point was when I stopped doing client work, I had every month I would change the wallpaper on my phone to say, are you having fun? And then have just like a fun like illustration or something that I made on it. Because I realized I stopped having fun. And like, that's why I got into this stuff in the first place. I got into this stuff because I saw Toy Story and it looked like so much fun to work on that and make that and get paid for it. Amazing. And so now I think that that's a big part. And that's my like design system goal thing is like, when I work with teams, I want them to have fun. I want design systems to enable fun. So we focus on that a lot, you know, rather than just the components or the APIs or all that stuff.
So I'd like to close the podcast with my guests letting the listeners know what they currently have going on and where people can find you online. So the floor is yours.
All right. Thanks. Well, I mean, that's tough because you plugged everything that I've got already during this episode. Super Friendly does design system work. If clients are looking for design system help, the way that we do it is we coach. So very rarely now do we bring on like a full team of designers and engineers. We mostly bring on 2 or 3 coaches at most, and we work directly with in-house teams and the team there. So if there's a team out there that wants that or interested in that, please get in touch. Let's talk to you about it. That's one thing. I'm writing a book about design systems right now. And so that's been taking up a lot of my time and brain space and figuring that out. And aside from that, the only other thing I'll plug is find a cause that you're passionate about, especially with people who need help somehow, and give them money if you can. A couple bucks, couple hundred bucks or thousand bucks, whatever you can afford. But that has been really helpful to me and my family to just find something that we believe in and support it. And I think that more people could use support. So whatever the cause is, it doesn't matter to me, but I hope that everyone gets a chance to do something like that.
Definitely. Well, Dan, thank you for coming on and spending part of your day with me. I appreciate it.
Thank you for inviting me.
Yeah, definitely. And it's been a pleasure being able to catch up and talk some shop with you and, you know, razz you about the Sixers a little bit.
right. It was just enough. Yeah.
just enough. I know where to toe the line.
I appreciate it.
So, you know, go buy the book, Pricing. What is it?
Yeah. Pricing Design. Yeah.
Pricing Design. I'll off camera have to ask you about the other one.
Cool.
I'd like a little bit of the scoop here. And yeah, super friendly, you know. Get a hold of them if you need design systems help and coaching, because they're great. And so with that, I'd like to thank you again for coming on. And thank you, listeners, for tuning into the Front End Nerdery podcast. I'll be back next time with a new guest, new conversation about front end design, development, or any other topic that we can think of. I don't know. But if you would, please rate this podcast on your podcast device of choice. Like, subscribe, and watch on the Front End Nerdery YouTube channel. Links to transcripts and show notes are there, because the podcast is as accessible as I hope it is and create it to be. I'm Todd Libby, and this has been the Front End Nerdery podcast. Thanks, and we will see you next time.